Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes the Meyerson Symphony Center such an important anchor of the Dallas Arts District, and how has the scene grown since the Meyerson opened for business 25 years ago? Relative newcomers to Dallas may only know the concert hall as what it is today, an acknowledged gem of the Arts District and a point of pride throughout North Texas. But as my guests will explain, in the years leading up to its construction, many residents doubted that it would be worth the expenditure of public funds, while others actively lobbied to prevent its construction at all. Jerome Weeks is a reporter for KERA's Art and Seek. Laurie Schulman is author of the 2000 book, The Meyerson Symphony Center, Building a Dream, and she is an annotator for the DSO. The Meyerson celebrates its 25th anniversary this year with a week of special events starting Saturday, September 6th. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The most remarkable thing for me to learn about the Meyerson's history was how many things might have kept it from being built in the first place. I want to start, though, with the champions of the project. How did the idea emerge that we needed this magnificent concert hall and it ought to be in downtown Dallas?
There were several factors at play. The orchestra had played for years at Fair Park Music Hall and then briefly at McFarlane Auditorium on the SMU campus. Neither venue was ideal, and there were many logistical problems, particularly at Fair Park. In addition to the fact that it's not a particularly good acoustical space, there were problems because the opera was also performing there, and when the opera was having its season, the orchestra basically had to suspend operations because at the time, the Opera Orchestra and the Dallas Symphony were the same body of musicians. That was something that was able to change when the Meyerson Symphony Center opened in 1989. But in addition, the Dallas Symphony had to transport all of its risers, equipment, large instruments like double basses and harps back and forth from a warehouse facility for each concert, and it was a logistical nightmare.
It was also true that the Dallas Symphony was in financial difficulty in the 70s, and they were not able to attract a major European conductor because they didn't have a really good hall. So all of that was seen as reasons to do something, and this was one of the, this was the answer they felt was to try and upgrade the hall. And that became the focus by 1979. This is what they needed to do. And at the same time, in the late 70s, there was this push towards creating the Arts District downtown. The city had two different plans. They weren't somehow opposed or anything. They were just sequential. One was the Sasaki plan, which actually confirmed what an earlier plan, Carl Lynch, had suggested, which was to create an arts district downtown with a collection of facilities and venues. That was a fairly bold idea because it essentially tied the future of downtown to the future of Dallas culture.
I think the city fathers were seeking to develop a venue that would enhance financial viability for the symphony as well. The concept of an arts district was ambitious, and we should point out that while the Meyerson Symphony Center was the first performing venue to be part of the arts district, it was not, in fact, the first building in the arts district. The Dallas Museum of Art was.
And that was 84 that it opened, right?
Yes, I believe that was an Edward Larrabee Barnes building, and it was a great point of pride for the city of Dallas. But, of course, the plans for the Meyerson Symphony Center were well underway by the time that the Museum of Art opened.
I have to make one correction. Actually, the Meyerson was the second performance venue because soon after the DMA opened, the Dallas Theater Center opened its Arts District Theater, a temporary facility.
Not the one people know today.
No, it was a warehouse space, which is where the Windspear currently stands. And they did it specifically because they saw that the Arts District was going to be the future. They wanted a new space. And so they put up a very quick temporary space, which lasted 21 years. So
That is correct. I do remember that space and how noisy it was during the thunder shower.
Yes, and precisely.
But for music, I believe that the Meyerson was the first performing space, and it has now got some very good company in the downtown arts district. It has come a long way.
What was the thinking in the late 70s, early 80s about how we would pay for creating a downtown arts district?
It was a complicated process that involved a lot of planning and a lot of consultation both within the city and among the city fathers and with outside organizations who helped the city to evaluate what its possibilities were. Because if you want to develop any sort of arts district, you need to acquire land. The process of land acquisition played a major role. There was also the subject of rethinking the city's sense of pride. This city was known still in the 1970s throughout the nation and to some extent throughout the world as the city where JFK had been assassinated. And I think that the psychological recovery from that took a very long time. The evolution of an arts district was a major step in helping the city to get past that and to redefine its sense of identity in a much more positive way.
I think people often see these facilities and just sort of assume they're there, they happen somehow, somebody paid for them. But they actually came about through very different means. For instance, it's important to remember that when the Kalita Humphreys Theater, the original home of the Dallas Theater Center, which still stands on Turtle Creek, when that was built in 1960, all the money was raised in advance, private donors. It was a million something at the time. That was it. There was nothing from the city in terms of raising money. So when Dallas set out to create this arts district to do it a public-private partnership, it was not pioneering. Other cities had done similar sorts of things. But to do something as they did with the Meyerson, where the city was kicking in 60% of the costs of the building, that was different. The DMA, when it opened, had less than 50%, more like 41, 47%, something like that, of its money came from a bond election. But the Meyerson was following what was the Sasaki plan, which dictated 60% funding from the city, 40% from private donors. Then the city takes over the ownership and maintenance. It essentially becomes the landlord. So those are very different kinds of ideas of a building. One is very much the city has invested in this. The other is a group of private arts lovers get together and build this thing.
How much of that 40% of private funding came specifically from Ross Perot?
About $14 million.
That's actually a very difficult question to answer because the cost of the hall altered significantly from the original planning stages through when it finally opened. And the original projections and the development of this concept of the 60-40 public-private partnership was a complex process that evolved over the course of several bond elections, one of which actually failed. So the portrait of how this was evolving changed significantly almost every individual year in the late 1970s and in the early 1980s.
My figure of the $14 million comes from that's what the $10 million was what Ross Perot originally gave to have it named after his vice president, then president of EDS, Morton Meyerson. Subsequently, they came back to him for various enhancements and embellishments, and he gave more money after that. But that's the number figure we know of his. But as Laurie says, it's actually a very complicated question what you include in the total cost. Do you include Betty Marcus Park, which is the thin park that runs alongside the Meyerson? Do you include the underground parking garage, which the city mandated? The symphony had no plans to do that. But many people think the city's paid for it, therefore that figure should be included. If you include land acquisition, the servicing the debt, all those sorts of things, it's a very different figure. So the official figure that the symphony gives out is $81.5 million. That's what they give out. That's what they stick with. But it's much higher than that when you include all these other things I mentioned.
And there were people at the time who were arguing that whatever the city's portion was too much money to be spending on something that by some was perceived as really a prize for the elites of Dallas and not necessarily a facility that would welcome the whole city.
Yes, that was a problem then because of the racial makeup of Dallas politics. At the time, we were still dealing with single-member districts. I'm sorry, at-large districts. We were dealing with at-large districts. And it wasn't until federal judge Jerry Buckmeyer mandated single-member districts that we were able to get minority representation on city council. So essentially, the leaders of the minority groups were saying, we're not at the table. We're not able to make any decisions on how this money is being spent. Therefore, you're spending our money without our elected input. So they protested. They saw this as money that was going to the wealthy, not to them. The DSO has done a lot to diversify its audience since then.
Through programming, that sort of thing?
Yes, and through outreach programs, right. So it's not as much an issue as it was then. Then it was simply people were excluded from political power, period. And therefore, they resented anything that was being done without their input.
There were other factors at play, particularly during the 1980s. And I would pinpoint 1985 and the years immediately following as a particularly testy time because the economy was in a terrible downward spiral. Really, at its worst, it was worse than 2008 and 2009, which I think is a very real memory in a lot of people's minds locally.
The unemployment reached 9% in 1987 in Texas. It didn't reach that in 2008, 2011. So we had a much worse time in the late 80s. It was so bad that Dallas was the leader in vacant office space up until 1993. So well after the recession and the rest of the country had receded, Dallas still had tons of vacant office space.
There were abandoned skyscrapers that the developers had simply walked away from. And here was the Meyerson Symphony Center tenaciously moving along and actually by about 1985, 1986, adding in enhancements to improve the space and make it acoustically more viable that had been eliminated in the early 1980s.
Tell us about, I don't want to just call him the namesake because Morton Meyerson was a driving force behind the construction of the Symphony Center. Tell us a little bit about him.
He was identified by Robert Deckard, then president of the Dallas Symphony Association, to head a committee, a concert hall committee, that would oversee the large-scale planning for this concert hall, and that included the selection of an architect, the selection of an acoustician, and eventually the selection of a construction team. It would oversee the relations with the city of Dallas, since we knew early on that this was going to be a public-private partnership. It involved liaison with the city manager's office and other people who became active in the planning for the project. It was an enormous undertaking, and Mort gave selflessly a great, great deal of his time. When Ross Perot announced that he wished to give a $10 million donation with the proviso that the hall would be named for Mort Meyerson, it came, I think, as a surprise to people who did not know that much about the project. I don't think it came as a surprise when they thought about it to anyone who had observed how hard Mort was working, the endless hours that he had devoted to overseeing every aspect of this on top of all of his commitments in his very high position at the time at EDS. What Ross Perot was doing was thanking Mort for his investment not only in Ross Perot's company, but in the city of Dallas and his selfless insistence that we really needed a great concert hall for our city.
We're looking back on the 25 years of history of the Meyerson Symphony Center with Laurie Shulman, who is an annotator for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra and author of the 2000 book, The Meyerson Symphony Center, Building a Dream. Jerome Weeks is with us as well. He's a reporter for KERA's Art and Seek. If you'd like to join us, ask a question, share a memory of the Meyerson or of the Arts District, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
That is DSO principal bassoonist Wilfred Roberts on the Meyerson stage, playing a portion of the bassoon solo from the second movement of Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade. You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the 25th anniversary of the Meyerson Symphony Center with Jerome Weeks of KERA's Art and Seek and Laurie Schulman, author of the 2000 book, The Meyerson Symphony Center, Building a Dream. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That was recorded, I guess, by you, Jerome?
By Dane Walters, our video and sound man, and during my interview with Wilfred on the stage.
It sounds amazing, even though it has been, you know, it's gone through a camera, and obviously some of that has to do with the remarkable acoustics there. Now, the acoustic design was done by a different individual than I.M. Pei, who was the architect. It was Russell Johnson who did the acoustics. Is that right?
It was Russell Johnson's firm, Artek Consultants. It was a very small firm in the late 1970s when he was first considered for the acoustical appointment of the Meyerson, which, of course, was not yet the Meyerson. It was the Dallas Symphony Hall. And he was an eccentric individual who had what were at the time considered some fairly radical ideas. He wasn't number one on everyone's list of the great acoustical teams out there. And the things that he was proposing were different from what the interviewing committees were hearing from other people. I thought it was really impressive that Mort Meyerson insisted that the musicians be involved in the selection of the acoustical team. And one after another, they came back to Mort and to the people who were at the head of the Dallas Symphony Administration, Leonard Stone, and to the board. And they said, Russell Johnson and Artek Consultants are the ones who are talking stuff that sounds to us like they really know what they're doing. They seem to understand music better than anyone else we have spoken with.
I just wanted to point out with that recording, what's interesting about it is I think you get a better sense of the hall sound than you do the DSO's recordings, because the DSO recording wants you to hear the symphony. They want to hear the instruments. And they do that the Meyerson. It's wonderful for hearing it. But they don't want you to hear the room, the echo. And it's also the hall when we recorded that was empty. So because the microphone was very close, you could actually hear the metal keys on the bassoon clicking as he played it. But you also could hear one of the things that's notable about the Meyerson, and that is the tail, that little echo at the end that where the note seems to hover in the air. And that's one of the things that's remarkable at the Meyerson is that if you have too much of that, the notes begin to blur. They become muddy. You need that, but you also need a certain amount of crispness, clarity. And it has both to a remarkable degree. Jaap van Zweden points out that if you whisper in the hall, you can hear it clear across the hall.
Now that you said this, Jerome, I wonder, Shelley, can we cue that same piece up again and hear it once again so we can pay attention to everything that you've just described to us? So what are some of the features that Johnson designed that make the audio quality, the sound quality when you're sitting there so remarkable?
The most important factors for good acoustics in a concert room are size, shape, and materials. And each of those has very specific things that affected the way the interior of the McDermott Concert Hall was designed. The size of the hall was limited to a lower seat count than they had originally foreseen. Higher seat count means higher revenues if you sell out the hall, but it can compromise the sound. The shape of the room is something that they were thinking about very carefully because they knew that Fair Park Music Hall, which is a wide fan-shaped room, was bad for acoustics, and they were taking their cue from the great concert halls of Europe, specifically the Musikvereinsaal in Vienna and the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. In this country, I think they looked very carefully at Boston Symphony Hall and at Carnegie Hall in New York. All of these designs had an impact on their thinking. They eventually started with the concept that a shoebox shape would give them the best possibility for the kind of lateral sound reflections that they knew would yield good acoustics. It is a common misperception when listening to a symphony orchestra that you are hearing sound coming directly at you from the stage, for example, if you're sitting in rear center orchestra. You are actually hearing sound coming at you from the sides, reflected down from the ceiling, reflected up from the floor. And one of Russell Johnson's acousticians, Nicholas Edwards, actually designed a program that is now a widely used computer program called Images that helps track the performance of sound waves in a room to help maximize those lateral reflections for the best kind of sound. This leads to what Jerome referred to a little bit earlier, what the acousticians call audible tail, that sense at a cutoff of the sound just hovering in the air. Not an echo so much as reverberance. The beauty of what Russell Johnson and his team at Artek designed is that they gained both reverberance and clarity in the sound of the Meyerson. The third aspect of how this was affected is the materials. Hard materials will give you better sound reflections. What you don't want is carpet. What you do want is wood or plaster or in some cases marble, although marble might be too hard and excessively reverberant. They thought very carefully about every single material on the seats, on the sides, on the ceiling, and on the floor, and of course, the stage itself.
It's important to note that when the Dallas Symphony Association set out to try and recreate the sound of the European halls, it's not possible today to rebuild one of those halls. It simply isn't financially possible. Also, the demands on handicap access, the fire regulations. Also, we prefer bigger seats, more restrooms, all these kinds of things, air conditioning, all that. It would not be physically possible or feasible, economically feasible, to try and replicate one of those halls. It wouldn't be permitted. So the holy grail for modern acoustic experts was, how do you get that sound without doing that, without creating massively thick masonry walls and creating a wood building? So that's what they were trying to figure out how to do.
Was the design of this thing, like Johnson and his team at Artek are working in one place and IMPE is working in another, and then at the end they sort of got together and shared? How does that work exactly, the collaboration between the person doing the acoustic design and the person doing the rest of the building?
Historically, the architect has been in charge and the acoustician was hired by the architect or was reporting directly to the architect. Right. One of the most important decisions that Mort Meyerson and the Concert Hall Committee made was to give the architect and the acoustician equal footing. It made for a bumpy road, but it also made for a better hall.
Their disputes became legendary because essentially they were both trying to control the same things, the mm-hmm. shape and the makeup of the interior hall. And so then naturally they're going to bump into things. Some of Russell Johnson's requirements looked unattractive, and Pei's people had a hard time with some of that. But for instance, the shape of the hall, Pei had to agree to that before he was designing anything. He was already, essentially, Johnson had said, this is the way it's got to look. That was often the decision of the architect, how do I want this thing to look? And here Johnson was already intruding on it. So as things went on, there were some incredible, I mean, it went all the way up to Meyerson at times in which they had to try and, you know, have committee meetings, sit down, let us decide this, because at times Pei or Johnson were threatening to quit over the disputes that were going on. So everything, the seats, the canopy, everything was a cause for debate.
Russell Johnson would object, it's going to have an adverse impact on the acoustics. I.M. Pei would object, it's going to have a terrible effect on the aesthetic beauty of the space.
Pei was worried that the interior of the hall was going to be very conventional and traditional as opposed to the stunning lobby. The lobby he was making into this remarkable modern masterpiece. And he was afraid that the hall was going to look much almost dowdy in contrast.
At the same time, I think he grasped early on that the lobby and the public spaces wanted to embrace all of downtown, which was evolving as a modern skyscraper city. And he knew that the audience wanted to enter a different realm when it went into the concert hall. Today, at the most basic level, if you've just even seen the hall, you know that there are white marble expanses and glass, and during the daylight, it's filled with sunlight, and during the evening, the building seems to glow from without with the lighting from within in the public spaces. Yet when you enter the concert room, it's all warm earth tones and an enveloping environment that feels intimate in contrast to the public expanse of those lobby areas, which I believe per person for the capacity of the hall are still the largest in the world.
It turned out what could have been a weakness actually is a tremendous strength. Scott Cantrell, the classical music critic for the Dallas Morning News, has called it a tremendous theater. If you think about the way you enter the hall, you come in through typically through the parking garage. And so it's this dark, low-ceilinged space. And you walk in into the grand staircase and you enter, and this incredible, gleaming, white, open, cavernous space appears above you. And you walk into that, and because it's hard-surfaced, it's going to be very active, energetic, noisy, clattery, but that gives a crowd energy. Mm-hmm. And then, as Laurie says, you enter this sort of warm welcome, and it's hushed. And it just feels the perfect thing to listen to music. And you go out intermission. You go back into this kind of cold bath of action and energy and noise. You come back in. And it is, as Scott says, it's kind of a theater. It's very dramatic. And it's before you even hear a note.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Debbie in Addison. Hi, Debbie.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to just share a memory of the Meyerson, and it's certainly a good tie-in to the conversation about the acoustics. Shortly after the Meyerson opened, I was treated to a concert for my birthday, and some friends took me to see Tony Bennett perform. And at one point during the show, Mr. Bennett stopped to compliment the acoustics of the building and very casually said to the sound engineer, "Hey, shut everything off," and proceeded to sing Fly Me to the Moon a cappella. And while I have no memory whatsoever of what the inside of the space looks like, to this day I will never forget the sound of Tony Bennett's voice floating.
That's a great story.
I saw Tommy Tune perform there, and he added something to the hall's accomplishments that no one had thought of. He said in building the stage the way they did with a lot of stone, solid stone, so he said they made the perfect tap surface, and he proceeded to show. I mean, they had removed the usual wooden risers that are there for the orchestra, and he was just tapping on that granite surface, and it rang out.
The stage floor is wood.
Okay. But the rim,
yes,
rim is
the
done.
Front rim the rim, is yeah. done in marble.
And it was
yes.
just it was just a perfect. I don't know what the word is, the tintinabulation of his toes on that, really kind of amazing.
What's remarkable about your caller's observation is that she would have heard the hall in a configuration specifically designed for a Pops concert, when they extend curtains that help to absorb some of the reverberance that is preferable for a large symphonic performance, but not preferable for a Pops performance where you might have amplification. Turn everything off, Tony Bennett said, as she recalls. And that would have been all of the electronica that would have helped for the electric guitars and the amplifiers and all of that. You don't have that when an orchestra is playing because they are playing on acoustic instruments. And with those curtains retracted, the hall is even more reverberant and yet always retains that exquisite clarity that makes it so special.
Tell us about the organ.
It is one of the great concert organs in the world, and in my opinion, it is one of three factors that makes the Meyerson Symphony Center one of the great concert halls. Great architecture, great acoustics, a great organ. It's a magnificent instrument.
It's remarkable that the hall has the organ because, as I believe Mark Melson, the former director of operations, put it, the organ is almost the first thing cut from the budget when you're building a concert hall. Many, many concert halls do not have an organ in front.
They're not used all the time, that sort of thing.
No. I mean, it makes an impressive-looking statement, as it were, but they're incredibly expensive. And so when you're going through the budget, it's the first thing to get cut. So the fact that we have an organ in there and that it is of such high quality is remarkable in itself.
The organ was built by the C.B. Fisk Company of Gloucester, Massachusetts. It was not installed completely when the hall opened in September of 1989. The organ actually had its own inaugural ceremonies and festivities about 3 years later. And it does take that long to completely build and install a major organ like that.
They call it voicing all the pipes. So there are more than 4,000 in there. So there were 70 in the front. So it looked complete. It looked good.
That's called the facade of the organ, and that is what people see when they look at the stage, that very impressive facade.
So what they heard that night in the opening was an electric organ that was sort of secretly playing.
So nobody knew that it wasn't the actual Fisk organ?
I don't think anyone in the audience necessarily knew. They also had a blower to blow air into one of the big pipes for the Mahler Resurrection Symphony. You need this one big sound. And so they sort of augmented the electric organ with that.
But well, it's show business, right? So it's got to be a little of that. We're speaking because of the 25th anniversary of the Meyerson Symphony Center with Lori Shulman, author of the 2000 book, The Meyerson Symphony Center, Building a Dream, and KERA's Art and Seek reporter, Jerome Weeks. If you'd like to join us, share a story, or ask a question about the Meyerson, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
That is DSO organist Mary Preston playing the final movement from Mendelssohn's Sonata in F. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour in honor of the Meyerson Symphony Center's 25th anniversary with Jerome Weeks of KERA's Art and Seek and author Lori Shulman, whose 2000 book is called The Meyerson Symphony Center, Building a Dream. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And Jerome, just to confirm, that's the real organ that we just heard there.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. In fact, I had the rare pleasure when we recorded that. Most people, I think, have never heard the organ with an empty hall. And so I was recording the topmost balcony. We had other mics elsewhere, but I was up there. And when she chose that because it's a very lively piece, and she says it's a crowd pleaser because there are lots of notes, meaning her hands are going all over the keyboards and her feet are pumping, and she's also pulling out stops. So it's a very active piece, but also because it uses some of the biggest pipes, the 32-foot Bombard, it's called, the biggest pipes. And when that thing sounds and the note sustains, up top there, it rattles the seats. And she also said people love that kind of physical experience from an organ. It rattles the seats. It was really amazing to hear.
It also shows off several important acoustical parameters of the hall, because when the full organ is playing, you want the canopy at the highest possible setting, and you want the reverberance chambers open so that you can approximate the sound of a cathedral. Part of the beauty of the Meyerson's acoustics is that it has adjustable elements like this so that the sound can be altered to suit the music that is being performed. And you will notice that if there's a performance for organ solo, as we just heard, or with organ and orchestra, the canopy will always be at a much higher level than it is for certain other repertoire.
And when they lower the canopy for something like a Mozart piece by Mozart, much smaller sort of chamber piece, the canopy essentially blocks access to the reverberant chamber, which is up above. And so it's a much narrower, smaller space, kind of like what Mozart composed for. And with fewer instruments, the hall doesn't have to be as big and vast as a cathedral. And so Jaap van Zweden has said that it is amazing that the hall is able to do both extremes.
The canopy is actually a series of canopies. Only the large one, the one that I.M. Pei's people used to call the Starship Enterprise, that's the only one that actually moves. The others are stationary canopies. They are very close to the color of the ceiling, which is a very soft kind of nighttime sky blue. Those canopies do not move, but they do affect the way the sound behaves in the hall.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Tom in Dallas. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Chris. Thanks again for another wonderful show. And I cannot believe it's been 25 years. Just amazing. Dallas has grown up so much around the Symphony Hall. I don't think people quite realize what sat there before. Is it in the book what was on that site prior to the Symphony Hall?
It is indeed. It was a Borden's dairy processing plant, and there was a Lone Star Cadillac dealership. There were actually several parcels of land that had to be acquired, and it was a complex process that took place between the late 1970s and the early 1980s when I.M. Pei realized that he actually needed more land for the ultimate footprint of the hall. But yes, that information is included in the book.
It's a Byzantine story because of the land swaps. Borden's didn't want to move until they had a new home. And so it became incredibly complicated. Even when it was all seemed to be done and done, then Attorney General Jim Maddox objected to it because he said that the city had promised some of the land for a freeway ramp for Woodall Rogers, and therefore it was state. And so they had to go and negotiate all of that. Just when they thought they were free and clear, the state comes in and says, no, you're not.
It actually led to a lawsuit against former assistant city manager Vic Soom, briefly.
Did the construction of the Meyerson help to guarantee that the rest of the arts district as we know it today would actually get constructed? Because putting the DMA there was, I think, a giant first step. But I wonder if people were not quite sure if this would be a district or just a really lovely museum in downtown Dallas.
Oh, precisely. I mean, one building doesn't make a district.
Mm-hmm.
And although, as I said earlier, the theater center had stepped in, it was temporary. So it was just this little toehold. It still wasn't a district. It was not only that the Meyersons kind of confirmed, yes, we were going to do this, and that we were willing to do it through this kind of arduous, crazy 10-year process. The success of the Meyerson, this achievement, also indicated the district could be significant. It could be phenomenal, that this was a huge addition. If they had done a very nice symphony hall, I think we'd still go forward. But essentially, it raised the bar. It didn't just say it's going to be a district. It has the potential to be a very important district.
The building was such a stunning success from its opening concerts and the press attention that came from all over the world during the grand opening fortnight. gave tremendous presence to Dallas as a city that was on the rise, as an orchestra that had improved dramatically, but mostly this magnificent building was just getting rave reviews from virtually everyone. And within a very short time, all of the controversy that had swirled around it, particularly in the last year or two leading up to its opening, had virtually evaporated because the city realized we have this tremendous winner here. This is the most wonderful thing for our community.
It takes a tremendous amount of civic will to do something like this. If there wasn't that impulse after the Meyerson, nothing would go forward. I mean, why? Who's pressing for this? I mean, the arts organizations might need a new home, but that's often not enough to move forward on some of these things. And to have the kind of success of the Meyerson gives a large portion of the population the sense that, oh, this can work. We are special. We can do something on a global scale, as it were, that on a global stage. That produces a tremendous amount of energy. When you're dealing with a blank slate, it's harder to get people to imagine what can happen. But when you have the Meyerson, it's sort of proof. Look what we can do.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Lolly on the phone in Tyler. Hi, Lolly.
Hi. I wanted to ask the guests what they, during a pop concert, what section do they think is the best place to sit? I've sat on the floor up near the front, and I've sat in the choral section behind the stage there, and I sat up way up at the very top in the back. And I prefer way up at the very top, but I never have sat down in those middle sections, and just wondered what they had to say about that.
Lolly, you raise a very good point because it's a very personal thing where you sit and how you perceive music. There are some people, particularly for a Pops concert, who want to be really close to the star. But I agree with you that the best seats in the house are in the uppermost part of the grand tier. The sound is absolutely fabulous up there. On the other hand, if you're seated in the choral terrace, you get to watch the conductor, which is a unique perspective as well. There are, in my opinion, no bad seats in the Meyerson Symphony Center. That's one of the miracles of the space.
Interestingly enough, Art and Seek has launched a website today on the Meyerson, and part of it has five key questions. And in all of our interviews, we asked people like Jaap van Zweden, Jonathan Martin, the president and CEO of the Dallas Symphony, and musicians that same question. What was their favorite seat and where would they sit? And it's interesting that there was a variety of opinions. Many people do like the topmost. In fact, Jonathan Martin was talking about that very favorably, partly because all the sound seems to gather there. But in terms of clarity, some people prefer what's known as the Perot box. It's the center box, straight back from the stage.
At the loge level, one level above the orchestra floor.
And those are often the priciest seats. They have the best view, and they often get the best sound. If you go online to artandseek.org/Meyerson and you go through the website, you can go and find something like a dozen different opinions on what are the best seats. I think Lori's right. There's not really a bad seat, but it depends on your personal preference, what it is you're there for. If you're on the orchestra level, you're getting, you know, much more direct sound. It's kind of hot, as it were. It's coming straight at you. But you get different mixes. As I said, up top, all the stuff kind of collects up there.
And Jerome, there's the website at artandseek.org/Meyerson, and you've got a series of reports running through next Tuesday. Is that
That's right.
Right.
The first one ran today, history. Tomorrow it's going to be on acoustics. Bill Zeebel will be reporting on the organ on Monday, and I'll be talking about the future on Tuesday.
And eventually we can all find it online as well if people miss it.
Not eventually. You can find it all online. Right? Seriously.
It's
the
available.
Whole thing launched. It's a very complex, interactive. It has some wonderful videos, all these interviews that we've done. But it also has some views of parts of the hall that the public never sees.
What about tours of the Meyerson? Is it possible to sort of see it from behind the scenes?
There are tours being conducted next week in conjunction with the 25th anniversary, and tours can be arranged anytime by calling the Meyerson and requesting one. They have a team of docents who are very well versed in the history and specifics of the hall, and that has been done as a community service since 1989. It's a great program. Also, in conjunction with the symphony's celebration of the 25th anniversary next week, The orchestra and a number of guest ensembles are presenting a series of concerts. You can go on the DSO website to check out those. And on Monday, I will have as my guests for a Bach's lunch at 12 noon on stage. Morton Meyerson and acoustician Nicholas Edwards will be my guests for this Dallas Symphony Guild-sponsored event. It is free of charge, but they are asking people to make reservations, which can be done through the Dallas Symphony website.
Wonderful. Is it true that Ian Pei said, if I had it all to do over again, I would do some things differently with the Meyerson?
It was his first concert hall, he wanted a great hall. But as we said, all halls are forms of negotiation, and he had reservations about some things. As I said, disputes on some things. He would probably do it differently, but then he probably has a new idea for another concert hall he'd like to see.
Let's go quickly back to the phones. We have Larry on the line in Dallas. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, I just have a comment. For my birthday several years ago, my wife took me to the Meyerson when they were performing the St. Saint Symphony, the organ symphony. And I first heard this when I was a junior in high school back in 1966. And I was blown away. But she took me to that. And I was sitting there crying like a two-year-old when I heard this thing. It was unbelievable.
A lot of people have probably had similar experiences.
It's a great piece of music, and the power of music to move us is one of music's great joys. I still have to say that after 25 years, when I hear our orchestra play in that magnificent concert hall, it makes the hairs stand up on the back of my neck. It is a thrilling experience.
Is there, for people who are hearing this and thinking, I really need to get down there. Is there a good way to choose one's first concert? There are a lot of people listening who probably frequent the Meyerson, a lot of people maybe who have never dipped in and listened to anything there.
Interestingly enough, we interviewed a young cellist, a guy named Carlos Vargas. He's 20 years old. He went through Booker T, and he was a member of the Young Strings program. He found out that he was a member of the Young Strings program, which is this incredible program that the DSO offers to qualified Latino African American students. They will loan them instruments if they can't afford them. They'll send them to summer music camps. They mentor them. And Vargas says this was just changed his life. But he didn't know about it until the first night he ever went. He was been studying cello since he was in middle school. Mm. It was the first time he'd ever gone to the Meyerson. And so at intermission, his high school teacher basically said, that's your teacher up on stage, meaning he had been accepted. She was going to be his mentor, the cellist on stage. And he said that it was the perfect performance for him for his first time. It was full of Looney Tunes, things that he had heard as a kid. And he said that it was, you know, the William Tell Overture, things like that. I would recommend that you try something that you might have already heard or heard about. That the familiar may allow you to take stick your toe in the water and try the rest of it, because it's not going to be just that piece. It's going to be an evening, rather than just taking a flyer and a risk on what the heck is this? Let's see what it's about. If you find something that you've heard of, that you like, that you've want to give it a shot, I would suggest that. It worked for Vargas, although that evening was pretty special for him anyway, but he said it was the perfect night for him.
Jerome Weeks is a reporter for KERA's Art and Seek. You can see his coverage of the Meyerson at artandseek.org/Meyerson. Laurie Shulman is author of the 2000 book, The Meyerson Symphony Center, Building a Dream. The center's 25th anniversary is this year. There's a week of special events starting Saturday, September 6th. Wonderful to have you both here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. And we had help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.